It's Monday, April 22, 2013. I'm Albert Mohler, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Last week's tragedy in Boston escalated to the point of an international crisis, and as the arrest was made of the younger of the two suspects on Friday, it still turned out that there was much to be learned, and still, even now, much to be explained about the sad events in Boston, the motivations behind them, and these two young men who are at the center of the story. The arrest Friday night of Johar Tsarnaev brought to an end the active manhunt, and earlier that day, his brother, Tamerlan Tsarnaev, had died in a shootout with police in which he was also run over by the vehicle driven by his brother. It turns out that the turning point in the entire investigation came on Thursday and earlier on Friday when authorities decided to release images of the young men to the public. Now, once again, this is something like what the FBI and related law enforcement organizations had done in the case of the Unabomber, but this was unlike almost anything that had been done in the aftermath of 9/11. But what we have here is an indication that the public has become itself a massive law enforcement and investigative organization. Not so much in terms, of course, of having explicit legal power, but of having information. Information that the police authorities desperately need, and more information than they can actually handle and process. So, when the FBI, taking the lead in this case, made the decision to release the now very clear images of these two brothers, even though the FBI did not know who they were, they knew they had a picture of the suspects. Indeed, they had film, video of the suspects actually involved in the commitment of the crimes. Now, of course, we're talking about three deaths and over 170 wounded. We're talking about one of the most significant criminal investigations in American history, and we're talking about a case that raises all kinds of questions. And, of course, the earliest questions were the who, and the who is now known, Johar and Tamerlan Tsarnaev, two brothers, Chechenian by ethnic background, and both having come to the United States as youngsters under refugee status. The younger of the brothers, Johar Tsarnaev, 19, had been granted citizenship. His older brother had not, largely because the FBI had been tipped off by Russian intelligence organizations about the fact that he had been radicalized in terms of Islam. By the time the crime took place this past week, both brothers were well known, at least by their closest associates, as being Muslims who had been activated by an Islamicist agenda, especially the older brother. And as the two brothers were identified, it came very quickly to the fore that the older brother was assumed to have an enormous influence over the younger brother, acting in some ways as a surrogate father, since the father is more than half a world away. The older brother, Tamerlan Tsarnaev, age 26, was known to have become radicalized. As far back as 2009, he came to the attention of authorities both in Russia, where the Chechenian resistance has been carrying out terrorist attacks for years now, and here in the United States. He was actually interrogated by the FBI. However, he was then allowed to travel to Chechnya and Dagestan, and both of these are Muslim republics, at least in terms of their primary population, and both of them, according to the international media and national security experts, have become hotbeds for militant Islamic separatism. The New York Times reports that the Russian government had directed a request to the FBI's legal attaché in the American Embassy in Moscow as far back as January 2011. And even as Tamerlan Tsarnaev had spent time in Chechnya and Dagestan in 2002, he was clearly already on the screens of intelligence agencies in both Russia and the United States. However, in the United States, even though he was an active file, he was not considered an active threat. One of the things to note here is just how impossible it is to read minds. We would like to be able to read hearts and minds. This would certainly lead to an entirely new ability to investigate and, of course, to even prevent crimes. This has become the matter of science fiction. Remember The Matrix? But the reality is that we cannot read hearts, we cannot read minds, and we are able to read external cues only to a very limited extent. Just keep in mind of the fact that several congressmen and senators are already accusing the FBI of a massive intelligence failure in the handling of Tamerlan Tsarnaev in particular, and not even noticing Johar, there, 7 years younger, in the background. But not to defend the intelligence agencies, but to recognize the actual scale of the challenge here, how can any intelligence agency put together enough to know with absolute unerring precision who is and who is not a threat? But this is where the story gets more complicated and significantly more ominous. On Sunday, American law enforcement and intelligence officials indicated that they believe the brothers did not merely intend to set off the bombs at the Boston Marathon, but actually had a far larger terrorist agenda. When they kidnapped a man in order to steal his car, they told him that they were planning, after the bombing in Boston, to head to New York City. Furthermore, as Eric Schmidt and Michael Schmidt of the New York Times report, United States officials said they were increasingly certain that the two suspects had acted on their own, but were looking for any hints that someone had trained or inspired them. They also said that they had a small arsenal of guns, ammunition, and explosives when they first confronted the police, and most likely were planning more attacks. The authorities said that the original plot was becoming more and more clear in terms of detail. According to both the New York Times and the Boston Globe, authorities believe that Johar Tsarnaev, along with his older brother Tamerlan, had planned more attacks beyond the bombings at the finish line of the Boston Marathon. But the bigger question, and one that is being raised more vocally in terms of the international press, is whether they were alone, that is, the two of them together, or acting as a part of a larger cell. Some British newspapers reported that British intelligence had picked up evidence that the two were actually part of a larger cell, attributing this to information garnered from American intelligence authorities. The American intelligence officials seem to be saying exactly the opposite. But given the way intelligence is played, the reality is that we simply don't know. Even if the intelligence authorities do know, what they're telling us may be what they need to tell us. Which also points to another key insight from a worldview perspective in this story. Governments act on the basis of what they believe to be their responsibility and interest. Informing the public is an interest, but it isn't the ultimate interest. American history, that's right, the history of this nation, shows that there have been deliberate attempts by the government to mislead, even as it has been conducting anti-terrorism or anti-espionage efforts or investigating crimes. This was true during the birth of the FBI in terms of the age of the gangsters. It was certainly true also in terms of organized crime when the FBI was denying that it even believed in the existence of La Cosa Nostra or the Mafia, even as it was intending to raid and then to prosecute members of that organization. What we have here, of course, in terms of the international intelligence context, is the fact that not only our government, but every government is telling us so much and only so much as they want us to know and only what they want us to know. Sometimes true, sometimes false. Winston Churchill, back during the Second World War, spoke from this worldview when he said that truth is so important that it sometimes must be protected by what he called a bodyguard of lies. This is not any kind of excuse for dishonesty. It is the recognition that in a fallen world, dishonesty and honesty are sometimes both weapons in the hands of a government. Also on Friday, the central authorities of the Boy Scouts of America announced a new compromise position. This came after, just a year ago, the Boy Scouts of America insisted that it would stand by its ban on openly gay scouts and openly gay scouting leaders. But then, earlier this year, in February, the BSA announced that it was going to be suggesting promoting a changed policy, a policy that amounted to a local option for Boy Scout troops. The option would then allow local troops and their sponsoring organizations to decide whether they would or would not have openly gay leaders and openly gay scouts. Public outrage on both sides to that very, very untenable compromise eventually led the Boy Scouts of America to undertake to survey its own membership, asking them, as we discussed on this program, some very technical and specific questions about what they would and would not allow, would and would not support. On Friday, the Boy Scouts of America handed down another compromise. As one mother said, "I knew they would try to split the baby in the end." And that's exactly what they've attempted to do again. The first compromise was untenable. Now they're trying a second compromise. In the second compromise, there is no local option, but they split the two questions. According to the new policy, which now will go before 1,400 in the National Council of the Boy Scouts for a vote next month, will require all local troops to accept boys without regard to sexual orientation or the language that is used here, sexual orientation or preference. But the Boy Scouts of America will retain, in terms of its other policy, an outright ban on openly homosexual adults serving as scout leaders. Now, let's say at the onset, this too is the kind of compromise that simply will not stand. Because on the issue of sexual orientation, it stands on what must be identified as insufficient principle. Even if the Boy Scouts believe in the policy, they don't believe in it quite enough to be consistent on those two issues. Now, here's what to note. From the official statement of the Boy Scouts of America comes language that says this: while the BSA does not proactively inquire about sexual orientation of employees, volunteers, or members, we do not grant membership to individuals who are open or avowed homosexuals or who engage in behavior that would be a distraction to the mission of the Boy Scouts of America. That has to do with adult leaders, and that is the language that they're now sending to the public. They continue in their official statement, "Scouting is a youth program, and any sexual conduct, whether homosexual or heterosexual, by youth of scouting age is contrary to the virtues of scouting." Then that particular statement, they're trying to say that they want to deal only with the issue of sexual orientation. Sexual behavior on the part of scouts of whatever persuasion, orientation, or preference is out of bounds and in conflict with the values of scouting. They then continue, "The Boy Scouts of America does not have an agenda on the matter of sexual orientation, and resolving this complex issue is not the role of the organization, nor may any member use scouting to promote or advance any social or political position or agenda." That is perhaps the most unrealistic statement in the entire document. Whether they believe it or not, we can't say, but it is untenable on its face. To say that the Boy Scouts of America does not have an agenda on this issue flies in the face of the fact that the organization was willing to take this issue all the way to the Supreme Court, saying that the ban on both scouts and scouting leaders who were openly homosexual was a core value of the Boy Scouts of America. To change that means they haven't adopted no agenda. They've changed their agenda. But they've changed their agenda in a way that will, in the end, please no one. Now, let me state that there is every reason to have sympathy for young people, especially adolescents and teenagers, struggling with the issue of sexual orientation. The question is whether or not the Boy Scouts is an appropriate venue for that kind of struggle to take place. Most parents, by the very fact that they have indicated overwhelmingly their support for maintaining the ban, have indicated that they don't believe this is the arena or the kind of organization where that issue should arise, but it will arise. It will necessarily arise because of the change in this policy. They then, you'll note in that statement, said that it is not the responsibility of the Boy Scouts to resolve, quote, this complex issue. Well, they're going to have to try to resolve it one way or another. They may not be able to resolve it for the entire society, but they cannot absolve themselves of the responsibility to have taken a position by means of this statement. And a position, I will both predict and argue, is untenable in terms of any kind of sustainable long-term policy. This kind of compromise is a very weak halfway house between positions, and as we can already see, it is under attack from both sides. The final statement in the document reads, quote, "No youth may be denied membership in the Boy Scouts of America on the basis of sexual orientation or preference alone," end quote. Response from Christians and others who have been concerned about a change in the policy was swift. Leaders of the Southern Baptist Convention and other denominations indicated concern. Tony Perkins of the Family Research Council also indicated that this policy, in terms of a compromise, is unacceptable. He, along with others, accused the Boy Scouts of America of caving to outside pressure, which is exactly what they did. And they more or less acknowledged that during the conversation back in February when they said that they had to do this because of the pressure from organizations, including the major corporations represented in terms of the executive positions undertaken by members of the National Board of the Boy Scouts of America. But from the other side, from the advocates of the full inclusion of homosexuals, comes a rejection that, if anything, is even louder and more pointed than that that came from conservative Christians. For instance, Jonathan Capehart, writing in the Washington Post, says this: "Gay men and lesbians have children participating in BSA. Being active and involved in their sons' activities is vital. For those gay men who were scouts as boys, staying involved is essential to who they are as men, as citizens. Therefore, allowing troops to accept gay scouts only to bar them from leadership once they become adults is no progress at all." Chad Griffin, president of the Human Rights Campaign, told ABC News, quote, "What message does this resolution send to the gay Eagle Scout who, as an adult, wants to continue a lifetime of scouting by becoming a troop leader?" Alexander Petrie, writing for the Washington Post, says that the policy comes down to this, quote, "You are now welcome in the Boy Scouts if you are a gay youth, but bad news if you plan to stay gay and want to remain involved with the organization as an adult. That ban's not lifting. No, as soon as you are no longer a developing youth, whom the scouting code prevents from acting on any desires you might have, you are banned from being in the scouts. Clearly, the Boy Scouts understand how sexuality works. You turn it on and off at will. You can choose whether or not to be gay, just as you can choose whether or not to be a Boy Scout. It would be hard," she writes, "to think of a less courageous position." The Boy Scouts are fine with gay people as long as they're only gay in theory. It's almost a catch-22. You can be gay in theory. The second you step from theory to practice, you're either a youth in violation of scouting virtues or an adult who's just straight-up banned from the program. End quote. I read you those statements coming from different media sources, from those who are the advocates of homosexuality, to make the point that this is an untenable compromise, as most compromises on this kind of policy inevitably turn out to be. Because the issue of principle here is this. Either Boy Scouts should include homosexuals everywhere, in all places, in all contexts, or the Boy Scouts should stand by their current policy. Any deviation from this, the Boy Scouts had previously argued to the U.S. Supreme Court, is a violation of the very ethos and ideal of scouting. And of course, they were right when they made that argument. What we're looking at here is the kind of pressure that is being brought upon nonprofit organizations. You'll recall just in recent days we discussed the fact that the California legislature is considering removing the tax exemption of Boy Scout troops precisely because they discriminate at present against homosexuals. One has to wonder what the Boy Scouts think they have now gained as an advantage. Do they think that the California General Assembly is going to be satisfied with this compromise? Of course it will not. Will they still be considered discriminatory? Of course they will. So what have they gained? Well, they've gained very little. According to internal data released to the national media, the Boy Scouts determined that they would lose something like 250,000 members if they changed their policy and might gain 10 to 20,000. But of course, this isn't really an issue of math, it's an issue of morality. And the major issue here is not really who and who is not a scout. The real issue is whether society will abide by any organization, including now the Boy Scouts of America, that will stand by its own principles, at least this long, on the issue of homosexuality. But one thing to note, the Boy Scouts of America, by the attempt of this kind of compromise, have set themselves up for the rather accurate accusation from both sides that they've abandoned principle for an untenable compromise that will please no one. Finally this week, pay attention to the ongoing political debate about the legal status of Zohar Tsarnaev. This is going to be a very big debate this week, and it is absolutely filled with concentrated worldview implications. What rights or what status should a young man who's a suspect in this kind of crime with international connections be considered to have? That's not an easy question. The Obama administration seems absolutely determined to arrest him, Mirandize him, and treat him as a domestic criminal. There are many in Congress who believe that he should be treated as an enemy combatant. That's not a small question, but it's one that will consume a great deal of public debate this week. And it's one we should acknowledge that has vast worldview implications. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.